Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today for our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond are Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, former Pentagon comptroller Bob Hale, who among his many affiliations is with the Center for a New American Security, Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many affiliations is associated with CSIS as well. Gentlemen, thanks so very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
Great to be back, Vago.
Absolute pleasure having all of you guys on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage on this, the 10th anniversary of the Iron Dome system. Everybody, welcome back. Certainly an action-packed week with the President of the United States making his first address to Congress. Certainly historic because I think nobody has heard as many State of the Union messages as Joe Biden. Apparently, the record shows, and never before have we had women as both the Speaker of the House and the Vice President of the United States. So two women sitting behind Joe Biden was certainly very historic, as were some of these messages. I want to first start with the Aspen Security Forum. Certainly the administration appears, or at least Kath Hicks and Jake Sullivan, picked a very sort of bipartisan platform to sort of give an important address. Byron, you've been tracking this and brought this to our attention, that this was going to be sort of Kath Hicks' coming out party, and discussed a little bit, right, all eyes on her about what's coming up next from the administration, especially since, you know, aside from the skinny budget, we appear to know ever less about what's in the budget plan, although good news, Frank Kendall, you know, with blessing of the Senate, would become the Secretary of the Air Force. Heidi Shue would become research and engineering. Carlos Del Toro would become Navy Secretary. Talk to us, Byron, a little bit about some of the messages that we heard from both Dr. Hicks as well as Jake Sullivan today.
I think with Hicks, you're right. It really was the first event that she's participated in publicly since she was confirmed as Deputy Secretary of Defense. You know, she had a kind of an opening statement that I think was what you'd expect. You know, China is our main focus. It's the pacing competition. You know, we're looking at technology. We want to have a strong nuclear deterrent. I mean, there were no surprises, I would say, in any of her messages. And then kind of, you know, cycling through some of the Q&A part, you know, at the very end, the FY22 budget came up, and I thought it was interesting. She said she was almost proud of the fact that the only number that people seemed to be talking about in town was the top line, but no one really had any clue yet what the department was really going to do with all the different appropriations categories and programs. She said, look, we're going to have to take risk in some areas, you know, but at the end of the day, I think you're going to see a fairly balanced request that's aligned with these priorities that I set forth in the earlier part of the address.
Bob, you know, you listened to the address as well. Everybody on this panel knows Kath really, really well. What were some of the things that you heard? Because she did talk about driving the innovation agenda and trade-offs, right? And Byron, one way of listening to her comments was to sort of suggest that, you know, I'm glad everybody's distracted by the top line. That gives us some maneuvering room to make some choices. I don't know if I'm reading anything into her comments. But Bob, what did you hear? And then Dov, want to get your sense.
Okay. Well, I mean, Byron's right. There was not a lot of new ground, one slightly new ground I'll mention in a moment. But and she clearly reiterated this administration's intent to continue the focus on RDT&E. She mentioned phasing out old systems. So we're going to go back through that debate with Congress, because several administrations have been trying to do that in the past. The only focus, the only thing she picked out in substantive areas was a sustainable shipbuilding plan, modernized nuclear deterrent. The administration seems intent on making clear that they don't intend to back out of the nuclear deterrent. although how strongly they stay in remains to be seen. The one, I mean, slightly newer is not a surprise, I wouldn't call it. I mean, she spoke specifically of a data-centric budget and identified artificial intelligence and machine learning as examples that they would try to revitalize enterprise analytic capabilities in the Department of Defense. It's not something that I've heard stated with that strength, and so we'll have to see whether they actually make some specific suggestions or proposals, I should say, of how to move forward. Austin has said that he doesn't just want to develop new technology, he wants to use that technology to try to improve the U.S. national security. So we'll see in the fiscal 22 budget when we see it probably in a few weeks, whether they make some specific proposals. Overall, no great surprises, but I thought that data-centric focus was interesting.
Dove, what did you hear, including from Jake Sullivan, that you thought was compelling?
Well, first of all, regarding what Kath said, I mean, she pretty much repeated what she has said before in the hearings. Frankly, on AI and the other cutting edge technologies, one key factor that I think people should bear in mind is Mike Brown coming on board. Mike, of course, ran the, I guess he's still running the Defense Innovation Unit. And if you're going to be serious about AI and machine learning and quantum computing and all the rest, you've got to be able to work with the outside world of beyond the DoD industrial base. So in a sense, the Brown nomination underscores what she was saying. With Sullivan, look, first of all, Jake already laid down a major marker when he and Tony Blinken were out in Alaska. And so it shouldn't come as any surprise that he and Kath are on the same page regarding China. And generally speaking, Sullivan, he doesn't seem to be the same Jake Sullivan who worked for Obama. I think he's really become I wouldn't say hardline, but he's no longer softline. And I think that's something that we're going to the extent that he wants to be public, and that's not entirely clear either, because national security advisors some have been very public like a Kissinger and some have been very much under the table like a Scowcroft. But to the extent we hear from him, I don't think we're going to hear a sort of soft kind of response to the kinds of crises we've got.
Well, right. I mean, every good national security advisor also matches their boss, right? So if you're working for a softer Obama and you're working for potentially a little bit of a harder Biden, you're going to be reflecting that difference. But Todd, let me bring you into this discussion here, because you know, when we were preparing for this, the joke was that, you know, we were like, hey, where are we on the budget and what are we potentially seeing? Very, and you, I think, joked like we actually might know less about the budget now than we did a couple of weeks ago, if that's really possible. You know, how do you view where we are? Obviously, you work with Kath Hicks very, very closely for a long time. She was the Kissinger chair there at CSIS before she became deputy. You know, just want to get your thoughts on all this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was saying that somewhat jokingly, but it seems a little true that we still, here it is, the end of April, we haven't been given a date firm and when the budget request is going to come out. Originally, they had indicated it would be May 3rd. That's this coming Monday. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. looking to May 10th, right, the following Monday, that's what Chairman Smith has called out as the drop dead date, that if the administration can't release the budget request by then it becomes virtually impossible for them to get the NDAA and appropriations bills enacted by October 1st, just looking at the legislative calendar for the rest of the year. You know, I'm actually eyeing May 24th, and I'll tell you why. Number one, it's a Monday. OMB likes to drop budgets on Mondays. But also, that is the day after the date that the Trump administration released its first budget request, which was May 23rd of 2017, is when the full request actually came out. So if they release it on May 24th, it will be the latest any presidential budget request has ever been submitted. And I've looked at the dates of these submissions going all the way back to the 1920s when it started to become part of the regular process. And so, you know, they may be looking at setting a record here. And, you know, what is most remarkable to me so far is how little of what's in that budget request has leaked out, because DOD has certainly wrapped up its decision making. This delay is almost entirely likely to be on OMB in releasing the full budget. So if those decisions are made, people know what decisions were made, what's in the budget, what's not, and it is not leaked out. So that is impressive.
Well, I mean, right, there are a lot of historic elements to this presidency. I believe this is the latest State of the Union by an incoming president, right, delayed because of the pandemic. And also, I believe this administration has already spent more money than any other administration as early in its tenure as it has. I want to get to Byron in a second, but I want to give an opportunity to our two comptrollers to weigh in on this. Bob, why don't you go ahead, and then Dove, give us your sense on where you think we are.
So my understanding informally is that the Pentagon has not only wrapped up its decision making, but transmitted the data to OMB. So Todd, I think we got a shot at May 17th, but I don't exceed the 24th, but it's going to be somewhere in there. In terms of Madam Smith, I mean, I respect him a lot, but I don't think a week is that big a deal. And then, frankly, they're going to have a CR as usually have CRs because of political differences, not because they got the budget late. They could get it done if they wanted to and they had the votes to do it, but they won't because there are going to be so many disagreements. We're going to go to another omnibus appropriation. I think that's become the norm. They need to get it up there as soon as they can, and I think they will, but let's remember they got almost no cooperation during the transition. And so they started from a standing start, the new administration, and that makes it tough. So I have some sympathy for them.
Dove?
Well, I agree there's going to be a CR. I think what Smith is really worried about is he doesn't want to be the first chairman in 60 odd years who didn't get an authorization bill out there. The authorizers will get their job done and the appropriators won't. And that's not unusual. Yes, there'll be a CR. I agree with Bob. I don't think a week here or there really makes that much of a difference. It might make a difference to the Hill staffers who don't get to sleep very much and have to work on weekends. But that's not the driving issue. What holds everything up, as Bob said quite rightly, is the politics of it, and that's not going to change.
Byron, have you picked up anything interesting from, right? I mean, we're in this unusual position where we're having hearings effectively without any budget, so they've become a little bit of a free-for-all discussion. I don't know how you want to put it, right? I mean, we don't leadership
in place. It's fascinating to see, you know, you kind of expect there's precedent to see combatant commanders come before Congress and talk about, you know, what's going on in CENTCOM or you know, the various geographic locations, you know. But what is interesting is I think House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee had a Thursday hearing on the Marine Corps Navy budget. And then next week they're doing hearings on the Army and the Air Force budget. So it's fascinating to have a hearing when you don't have a budget, but that's the new world we live in, I suppose. So, and I would agree. I mean, I don't think a week or two is going to make a big difference. I think it's, you know, we've also had earnings calls this week from the major defense contractors. It's amazing how few calls have come up about the FY22 budget. You know, tangentially about the F-22 program and the House Armed Services hearing we talked about last week. But boy, you know, it's just a very interesting environment of kind of this cone of silence that's descended over the FY22 budget.
Go ahead, Todd.
I mean, I take the point that an additional week or two is not going to make that big of a difference, but you know, we're looking at, it's already 3 months beyond the usual submission. Now, granted, it is the first budget of a new administration, but previous administrations, you know, like George W. Bush, the Bill Clinton administrations, they did manage to get that budget request out in early April. And so, you know, this is looking at, you know, we're already looking at like 6-7 weeks beyond, you know, what the Clinton and Bush administrations were able to do. So it is dragging on. And, you know, I've gone back and looked at the statistics here. Yep, always bet on a CR, right? Odds are we're going to start the year on a CR. Years in which, over the past 30 years, years in which the budget request was submitted on time by the statutory deadline, the average length of the CR was about a month. In years where the budget was submitted late, the average CR was closer to 4 months. So it does make a difference. And what you really don't want to get into is a really extended CR. Point taken that this is not the only factor that would contribute to the likelihood of a long-term CR. There's a lot of other budget politics, but they can't even start to work through those political issues that are broader than defense if they don't have a budget request yet.
I am going to put my vote on this one with Bob, right? These guys are starting 6 or 7 weeks late, in part because they weren't having the kind of meetings and interactions that you would have had starting in early November, and give people that sort of 2 extra months of planning time that didn't happen. Although that having been said, right, pretty much everybody had a fair, right? I mean, the counterpoint to that is everybody knows what the budget planning was in general terms. And you know, so it wasn't as blind as that. What I want to do is get to the State of the Union. As our senior most Democrat on this conversation, Bob, I thought I'd start with you. President did strike a lot of very important chords, right? We're in a competition. What's said in this hall matters not just to the country, but it's a message around the world. How American democracy is seen, invoked January 6th, you know, made the case we are Washington. What we do in this room is what drives the nation and the world. Let's stand up and show the world that democracy works when authoritarians are trying to make the case that they're a better form of government. He talked about national security. I mean, obviously made the case for his agenda, but what sort of struck me was the Buy American discussion that he raised. Some people were worried the Obama administration was being Buy American when it scrapped the presidential helicopter. You were there at the time, Bob, the C-27J, the Airbus tanker, you know, and everybody in the administration, you know, went on messaging mode saying, no, you know, the door is still open to allies and partners. Trump, however, came in, was talking about Buy American. And now there's a sense that Biden will actually drive change because he is going to harness the machinery of government. And there are some folks who, you know, the president said he'd abide by treaties, but, you know, defense is generally exempt from these treaties at the end of the day. I want to start off with you more broadly. What did you make of the president's message? And how do you think that it impacts national security in all of its forms? Then want to get Dove's take, Byron's take, and then Todd's. Go ahead.
Well, Vago, I mean, this was a speech that I think didn't focus on defense, certainly. It focused on foreign policy, and you listed some of the key areas. This is a China a budget, or will be, and concern from this administration, as we've seen, I think, from the past couple of administrations as well. But I think he spent most of his time on his domestic agenda. He was clearly out to sell it. I thought the most effective parts of the speech were when he was selling that agenda. When he got to the end, it was more of a menu, checking off all kinds of things, gun control, et cetera, that he had to say. But I thought he was more effective on selling the domestic agenda. And I think defense should listen to that domestic agenda because they need we need better education to provide the recruits that we will need in the future to make national security strong. And that's clearly one of his goals. Whether he'll get achieve it or not remains to be seen, but it's clearly one of his goals. Same with healthcare. I mean, we're seeing a decreasing number of American youth who can qualify for military service, some of it due to healthcare problems. So although it was a domestic speech, I think There were things in it for defense that could be important to the long term of national security.
Dove, what were some of your key takeaways that you think, right, go more far beyond merely budgeting and rhetoric?
Oh, well, to begin with, he emphasized human rights. In fact, I think he mentioned conversations with Xi Jinping twice, which is kind of interesting. And he kind of pointed the finger at the Russians' interference in the United States as well. Took a very hard line on that. But he did emphasize human rights, which also, of course, means that some of our allies and friends are sitting up and wondering, okay, what does that mean for us if I'm Sisi of Egypt or MBS of Saudi Arabia or Erdogan of Turkey and so on. So that, I think, was a major point. The other thing, the whole Buy America thing, I think, was frankly pitched to the unions and the blue-collar workers that he spoke so much about in his talk. By the way, he didn't call it, they're not calling it a State of the Union speech, they're calling it a speech to Congress. Don't ask me why, but that's what they're doing. He talked about jobs. I mean, that word appeared over and over and over again. And we know that that a lot of the blue-collar workers of the United States are against free trade, are strong supporters of Buy America. That's why Trump tapped into that. And so I think that was the pitch. I'm not sure that the second and third order consequences of, well, you know, we work with allies and we buy their stuff too, and we need it and use it in the defense world. I don't think that factored in as much as simply trying to make the pitch, as I say, to a voter bloc that Biden fought very hard to get away, to take away from Trump, and very hard, very much wants to keep as the 22 elections come up.
Byron, I want to get your sense a little bit on, I want to get your broad thoughts, but also on the Buy American issue, right? I mean, Dove, you were comptroller in the Bush administration, right? I mean, every president over the last 20 years, right, going back to Bill Clinton, was working to undo Buy American. John McCain was in the vanguard of that fight, and it was during Iraq and Afghanistan that we, in the crucible of war, opened ourselves up to foreign vehicle designs like the MRAP, armor, electronic warfare, new munitions. All of these were from all sorts of allies and partners, whether they were Israeli, Norwegian, French, British, South African, you name it. I mean, we were drawing ammunition from adversaries even at one point because we were running out of bullets. Byron, I mean, you know, what were some of the key elements? And, you know, Joe Biden has said, I'm going to give very, very few waivers on Buy American. Everything's going to come from me, and I've given that direction. That's right. I mean, if you're an ally and partner, just like you might be concerned about human rights language, do allies and partners need to be more than somewhat worried? Because, you know, Dove, you were one of the voices that beat back the effort that was in Congress, for example, to adopt Buy American language. Go ahead, Byron.
Well, the two, you know, I agree with what's been said about the State of the Union. The two things that I found interesting, you know, there were references to the range of threats. I think at one point Biden talked about the terrorism threat metastasizing. So you still have to be vigilant about that. And then I thought the other thing, back to the blue collar focus of all this, I think at one point during the address, you mentioned that 90% of the jobs that would be created under the American Jobs Act plan, as they envisioned it, wouldn't require a college degree. And I think it was only 70% wouldn't require a two-year college degree. So again, it's a very different pitch on some of this stuff, and kind of goes back to what Sullivan talked about at the Aspen security event today. You know, this is an administration that's come in with a big focus on better jobs, middle class jobs, and that resonated through the president's State of the Union. Now, to Buy America, yeah, Vago. I mean, I think it's nice to talk about working with allies, but, you know, is the bridge blown up when it comes to working with allies on defense programs and projects? I mean, I don't think the U.S. would have any problem in any way, shape, or form if, as, for example, Saab has done, they build a factory in the United States to build parts of the T-7 trainer program. But, you know, there's a degree too where, you know, for us, where there are products, technologies that other countries have, at a level, it might behoove the United States to buy those products and technologies. Because I think, you know, there's something to be said for also having a defense industrial constituency in some of these countries. They're not all going to buy from the United States. They are going to protect their own domestic defense industries. And I think to the extent that you might be able to rationalize some of these things so the United States isn't wasting money on something that someone else has already developed or has in production, and the same would go for the European and Asian states as well. Middle East, to the extent the Middle East is developing a defense sector outside of Israel, which already has a very well-developed one. So I would hope that, you know, that isn't, you know, that's kind of a chalk line that you snap, but you can erase it in different ways, but it can't be a brick wall where we're just going to buy American and that's it, and we're not going to help support the export industries of some of our allies.
Scott?
I knew you were going to do that.
I'm sorry. It's an inside joke. There's a mutual friend who, for some reason, consistently thinks Todd is Scott. So,
anyway. Oh, okay.
And well, I was Rocket Man.
Anyway, he's also Space Marshal. God, you know, it's so sad that you can't pick your Zoom handle anymore, because Todd, nobody had better handles than Scott did. Go ahead.
Pretty sure one time I was Mike Flynn.
You were Mike Flynn once. That's right.
Right. No, I would just add to what Byron said that, you know, it's absolutely right. It's got to be a two-way street, a lot of these things. And as much as we talk about, you know, whether or not this administration is going to be more focused on protectionist policies when it comes to the defense industrial base, you know, compared to the previous administration, other countries have the same thing going on, right? And so it's got to be a two-way street. You know, if we're smart about this, we will look at, you know, opening up, you know, some of these opportunities internationally for defense items and at the lower level, you know, subcontractors and components, doing it strategically, you know. So number one, doing it in areas that aren't going to create vulnerabilities for us down the road if there are disruptions in the global supply chain. But also in areas where we want to be reaching out and building better relationships with certain partners around the world, certain governments, or rebuilding relationships. And so I think that should be really, you know, our industrial-based policy should be outward-focused as well as inward-focused, and it should be part of our national defense strategy.
Dove, you worked some of these issues when you were comptroller in the Bush administration, and you guys, I mean, you know, you were doing both so much outreach externally and being a vetting agent, not to build you up too much, but there were a lot of folks who were bringing technology in part because of your past involvement in it, saying, hey, here's some interesting stuff for you. I know how hard Ken Krieg was working those issues as well. And you were dealing with a lot of political interference. Where are we going on this, and what are your concerns and the right way to do it, right? What do we onshore? What are we sensibly onshore? But what is it that we remain open to from abroad?
Well, let me start by saying that there's always been this misguided sense that all kind of innovation begins in the United States. And my experience, having traveled around all these industrial partners of ours outside the United States, convinced me years ago, and I've seen nothing to change that conviction, that very often they're ahead of us in certain technologies and certain weapons areas, which is why in the past we have bought foreign. And people like Sam Nunn, Arnold Panaro's old boss, was very outspoken about this. And at the time Sam was in the Senate, he was considered the expert on military issues. And he was very outspoken about the need for a two-way street. I think Byron is completely correct. We will find ways to get around any kind of Buy American issue if we want to get around it. And so the real problem arises within our own bureaucracy, where for all kinds of reasons, there's simply a desire not to buy from foreigners. And if we do buy, we change them so much, the products, that is, that they don't even look like what we originally were buying. But if we're smart. And since everybody is saying from Mr. Biden on down that we cannot do what we did in the past, which is essentially treat allies as a nice to have, but frankly, it was up to us and us alone. We need those allies. And if we stiff arm them on this, they're going to stiff arm us on in areas and at times that will make us very unhappy.
I just want to give a shout out right to the Trump administration, irrespective of what the president's language was. Fincantieri Marinette Marine still won with an Italian design or a baseline Italian design. The frigate competition, obviously Fincantieri is our spokesman. The ship is, you know, the fine design works being done in the United States by U.S. engineers and is going to be manufactured in Marinette, Wisconsin, right at the end of the day. But it, you know, it was interesting that despite the rhetoric, we can also act very, very pragmatically. And the F-35 is the product of global cooperation that spans back many decades. Bob?
You know, I like the way Dove put it. This was a blue collar speech to get votes back that the Democrats have lost. I think obviously there are a number of aspects to that, but Buy America was one. And as has been said here, if we want to, we'll find a way to get around it. We always do. So I wouldn't overreact, but he clearly made a point of it, I think, in good part for political reasons.
All right, we're entering a little bit of lightning round, given that we've got about 8 or so minutes left in the program. Byron, you and I listened to Emmanuel Chiva, who is the French Ministry of Defense's innovation man. I thought it was a terrific conversation at IISS, especially when he said sort of the days of artisanal munitions are over. And I just had this vision of, you know, as you put it, right, terroir and...
You know. Yeah, if we got into different vintages, I thought that would have been an even more fascinating discussion. But I thought the really interesting takeaway from the whole discussion was, look, they're just common issues that militaries are facing in trying to develop and foster innovation. And, you know, France stood up this unit in 2018. You know, it's the same set of issues. You know, how do you get more technology from the commercial sector? How do you change internal cultures? You know, he talked about a contracting factory where they're trying to, there are a lot of parallels with what the US is doing. And I just, it was a very interesting perspective. I think IISS is going to do some more of these. It'd be interesting to hear from some of the smaller countries recognizing that they are smaller countries and, you know, it's a difference in scale, but you know, the impediments, the problems, the challenges are pretty much the same. It's a worthwhile event. It's probably up on the IISS website or the YouTube channel or whatever. It's worth a listen if people have the time.
It was really a great discussion. Let me go to you, Bob, and talk a little bit about the paper and the conversation you had at Brookings Institution about PPBESE. Dove, you put the E in there, you know, effort obviously to help. Bob, talk to us about sort of the fundamental budgeting architecture and mechanism and why we need to sort of reconsider this at the end of the day and, you know, what works about it and more important, what might not be working that we need to fix.
Ovago DOD executes one of the biggest budgets in the federal agencies, one of the bigger ones in the world, and obviously how well it does that affects national security. So this paper, which was published by Brookings called Financing the Fight, focused on the first part of that, the budget formulation. And, you know, we've got a complicated budget formulation process, and I'm going to skip through the history and go to an assessment of that process and one major suggestion for change. Overall, I think the history and my personal experience suggests a lot of that budget formulation process in DOD helps the department, a multi-year focus, bringing analytics to bear, looking at things in programs so you avoid duplication. But there are some changes that are needed. The paper lists a number. I'll mention one because it's important to this administration. And that is, I think we're struggling to have enough flexibility to move quickly enough to execute funds effectively, especially for high-tech projects where the technology is changing quickly. Congress needs to give the department more authority to move money around in execution, the budget and broader categories, so that we can keep up with technology. And I hope that this is an arcane issue, but I hope it's one this administration will push and that Congress will listen to, because I think we'll get a more effective defense budget process and a more effective defense budget.
Dove, your sense on Bob's appraisal of your good efforts to try to at least help the process. You know, at the time when you said the Donald, you were talking about Donald Rumsfeld, not Donald Trump.
Well, we never called him the Donald. First, let me commend to anybody who's listening to this, Bob's paper really is first rate, and it'll give you a good sense of the history. I'll give you a quick anecdote. When I was first being confirmed, I bumped into Bob McNamara, and he said, "Are they still using my old PPB system?" And I said, "Yes, they are." And he said, "My God, I haven't been secretary for many, many years." But I agree with Bob. There's a lot of goodness there. We need to be careful, first of all, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. When I added the E, I was hoping that we would treat execution as much more the way corporations do. With, you know, a corporate CFO can move money around very, very quickly, depending on the burn rate of the project in question. We just cannot do that. We still have these ridiculously low thresholds below above which we have to go to a minimum of four committees for approval. Any one of them can block it. So if you've got a new program, say in the high tech area, and it's not working too well, but you've got another one that is working well, but it's going to cost you $11 million, you have to go to four committees to have them all say, okay, that's nuts. $10 million on a $715 billion budget. We need to have much more flexibility, as Bob says. What I had hoped for was execution reviews every 3 months. In corporations, they can move money within weeks and within days. So yes, there are some things we absolutely must change, both internally and on the Hill. The appropriators are going to hate it because they want to have complete control. But there are ways even to deal with that. One person on the Hill said to me, look, if there's more flexibility, but there's some kind of audit at the end of the year and certification of what is being done, we notify about the move. We don't request the move, but then at the end of the year, they can check up and see whether what we did, we being the Defense Department, what DOD did was accurate, not a misrepresentation or some kind of slush fund activity. That might work. So there are ways with goodwill that both sides, Pennsylvania Avenue, as it were, the Pentagon and the Congress could work something out, because there is no way that this system will simply keep up with the speed with which new technologies are being introduced into the military sphere.
I thought it was interesting. You know, I remember at the time when you were Comptroller Dove, and you recounted that story about what McNamara had said to you. And I, as I recall, there was some public event thereafter where he would say, like, this is absurd. I mean, that was innovation circa 1960. We certainly shouldn't be still doing things this way. And I still find it incredible that we deliver the kind of security we do as openly as we do, right? I mean, there's greater transparency in our budget than almost any other country on the planet. And we do it with the degree of oversight that, frankly, no other Defense Department is subjected to. I think it's a testament to people like you, Bob, and you, Dove, working in the system to try to make the magic happen. And now, obviously, Mike McCord doing it again. Todd,
quickly, yeah, there have been a lot of changes, major ones, especially Mel Laird's, where he decentralized. McNamara's system was very top down and centralized. Laird decentralized it a great deal, which probably allowed it to survive, and some other changes as well. But the point's well taken. The basics of what McNamara put in place are still there.
Todd, let me bring you into the conversation and give you the last word. You are our man on space, as we pointed out, occasionally space marshal, space man, space commandante. A lot of elements from each of the services are moving into the Space Force. Do we know whether the right elements are moving into the Space Force? Because there's this sense that the Space Force might be a repository of what other people may not want, not what the Space Force needs.
Yeah, and this is a major concern for the stand-up of the Space Force to do it right from the beginning, is to make sure all the right organizations and programs and personnel and budgets get transferred, not just from the Air Force, but from the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps as well, and even some defense-wide agencies. That has been a work in progress. What we've learned in the past couple of weeks is that they appear to have reached decisions on what's going to move. They have not announced those yet, so we're waiting to see, you know, what are, how are they drawing the lines. It's not an easy thing, right? Because how do you define that boundary between space capabilities that you need in the centralized service responsible for the space domain and what residual space integrating capabilities do you need in the services, each of the other services? So it's not clear cut, but they've got to get it right, or at least pretty close to the mark right out of the gate here. You know, I would just point out that as they were moving things from the Air Force, you know, they started out with what they said were about 30,000 personnel, military and civilian, in the Air Force Space Command. And they were going to move Air Force Space Command. That was a nucleus for the Space Force. They didn't move nearly that many people. That's because they kept behind a lot of non-core, you know, space functions in the Air Force, and would, you know, just provide services to support space units. And that's fine. Hopefully they work out those boundaries well. But there are going to be a lot of other questions like that about support services and what do you, you know, keep in the home service or move to the Space Force with all the other services as well. And as you point out, you don't want this to become a dumping ground for the other services to get rid of missions or people that they don't want to keep, right? You want to make right. sure that this is being done for, you know, solid strategic reasons. And final thought, I would also commend everyone to read Bob Hale's latest report. It fills a vital gap in the literature out there of the budgeting system within the Pentagon. It's a very good read. Folks should go take a look at it. And, you know, we can't understand how to, you know, reform the budgeting system for the future if we don't fully understand how we got to where we are.
Before we go, not to go back to the topic of the delay in the budget, how much of this is not having the right information or a technical hang up in the system, including with OMB?
Well, I think at the end game, there's a period added, probably a week or two, to get the budget printed, to physically printed. Some of that may be the Congress that wants hard copies, I'm not sure. But I think today almost everybody accesses the budget online. And so I think OMB might be worth reconsidering whether they want to continue to publish this or just go ahead and put it out electronically and then perhaps provide a published a version a little later.
And Dove, your sense is that whenever delays happen like this, there are more, and I'm not, this is not all pile on the rabbit, and it's not like beat up OMB day. But it, and especially because Gordon as an OMBer is not here to defend the organization. That it really is an OMB issue, isn't it, more often?
Well, it is to some extent. I mean, my understanding is that this year OMB and DOD have actually been in quite good sync. But as Bob said, there's always that last holdup, and the last holdup is not DOD. It's the budget has gone over to OMB, and they're the ones that finally release it. And so, yes, given that we understand the budget is with those folks, the question has to be, what is the holdup?
Maybe this would be a great reform in the budget process to just stop printing the paper copy like Bob suggested. Because I'll tell you, you know, when I started at CSBA back in 2010, you know, the day the budget request came out that year, you know, some of the longtimers at CSBA came up to me and were like, oh, aren't you going to go wait in line to get your copy? And I looked at them kind of funny. I was like, but they post the PDF online.
Yeah.
Why would I go wait in line?
Well, and, you know, as a consumer of all this data and information, I got to throw in Congress and actually a call out for DOD, because I think, you know, one of the great great advantages the DoD added to my life was when they started adding Excel spreadsheets in the annual green book. I wish they'd do that for the justification books, but that's another story. And I think I would love it if congressional committees, when they do these bill markups, they had Excel spreadsheets that were associated with the budget items or the quantities. It's just, everybody's trying to sort through this information, and the more user-friendly you make it, the better it could be.
And Byron, hat tip for the budget pros, if you open up the P40s and the R2s, the PDF file, you go to attachments within the PDF file, it's got an XML file with all the data electronically.
And you can convert it to an Excel sheet. Good. Thank you.
You can find it.
We're all about giving people real world solutions here. I was gonna say, I remember when reporters used to have to wait online to get these things before you could write about the budget, and the budget briefs used to be on Saturdays of all times. So we used to.
Yeah, I remember that.
what was the thing? Edith, Bob, and Edith's Diner. I remember that. It was like early in the morning, everybody would show up, go to Bob and Edith's, or go to the Pentagon and then go to Bob and Edith's
to get something. And wait for people to fax you the documents.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope everybody has a terrific weekend, a great week, and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago.
Glad to be here, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.